This is Michael Scharf. The date is March 8th, 2011. I'm sitting with Secretary Robredo, who is the Secretary of the Department of Interior and Local Government. I'm a former mayor of Naga City. Mr. Secretary, thanks very much for agreeing to this meeting.
Yeah, good day, and thank you also for the opportunity. Now, I think the subject matter essentially will be my experience as mayor. So I was mayor in 1988, and this was really immediately after EDSA. So people were hopeful, and there were opportunities for young people like myself. I was only 29 then, to serve the government. And I took up the challenge of working in the government at the local level. So I ran for mayor. I won with only 23% of the vote. Majority of the members of the city council belong to the opposition. Naga City traditionally has been the premier city of the region, but when I returned, I was born in Naga. I took up until secondary education in Naga, then I moved to Manila. So when I returned in 1986, I worked in a national government agency. It allowed me to really look at the problems of the city, not the superficial ones, but the problems which I felt were retarding the development of Naga. So when the opportunity was presented to run for public office as mayor, I ran for mayor in 1988. As I've said, I won, but then I think the more important dimension of it was the kind of Naga that we had in 1988.
That's interesting. Can you maybe describe some of the major problems?
Let's say, for instance, Naga was, as I've said, traditionally the premier city of the region. But from a first-class classification from the Department of Finance, we were reverted to a third-class classification, in as much as there was not much investment nor increase in local income or local revenues. Now, offhand, of course, the superficial part is there was not much new investments, but I think it was not just opportunities. It was how the systems work, what incentives were given, the kind of infrastructure that we had during that time. And hand in hand with that was the doubling of the number of informal settlers since I left. If I recall it right, I think it was 20% of the population belonged to the informal sector. Now, of course, when you have all these types of problems, it reflects also on the service delivery system and service delivery outcomes of the city. So we were not really doing well in so far as education outcomes were concerned. And in like manner, the preventive aspects of healthcare, as seen by the indicators, were not really taken care of. And to my mind, the basic reason was that we relied a lot on national government. We did not raise local income. Raising local income is politically difficult, in as much as especially during the time that I ran for office. The term was now limited to, during the time, 4 years. So you have to demonstrate improvement in outcomes in that period of time. And without the money, how will you be able to do it? I think that was the challenge. Given the limited resources that the city had during that time, how can we improve the outcomes, get reelected, and build stakeholdership on what we were doing. Now, as I've said, the other dimension is political. In the Philippine context, when majority of the members of the city council belong to the opposition, usually what the mayor would like to happen doesn't happen. In like manner, what the council would like to happen doesn't happen. So it's really gridlock. And accepting that as a given, I felt that it might be good to look at the private sector as partners in making the system work. And given the fact that I was a minority mayor, I told myself that it was important to build constituency support coming from the non-traditional political supporters that you have in the locality. So we immediately addressed, we can say, long-standing problems that were doable but difficult, just to gain the confidence of the constituency. And I think that what was obvious was how we addressed the 10-year problems of the informal settlers. And to my mind, it was doable in as much as it was a new government. There were large owners of large tracts of land that institutionally, if we're able to negotiate and deal with them, we'll be able to resolve them. So one of the biggest landholders actually in the city is the Roman Catholic Church. So we negotiated with the church. The tenure problem has been there in the 50s. So we leverage on goodwill and we improve revenue collection. So we leverage on future income and goodwill, and assure the Archbishop that we'll pay the property upfront cash. So we settled that. Now, we also did the difficult. You know, the reason why there were not much new investments in the city was because it was constricted in terms of space, meaning it was confined to a 27-hectare property, the commercial district, and there was no room or area for additional investments. So we passed a local law relocating all the bus terminals outside that commercial business district. If I recall it right, I had 18 court cases, people opposing it. But to my mind, it will equalize land values, open new areas for development, create additional pedestrian traffic outside the commercial area, and bring about more investments.
Can I just ask? I think that's fascinating. When you first came to office, though, in terms of setting your priorities, you mentioned before one of the greatest challenges was the lack of money.
Lack of
finances there. So how did you... your first day on the job, how do you ascertain what the priorities are going to be? And then to follow on to that question, how do you determine what you do first?
Now, the first thing that I did really was try to figure out where I'll get the resources, whether it be technical, whether it be financial. So financial, I remember all the processing of licenses went through my table, and we negotiated with the businessmen in the community, in the city. I told them that I do come from a family of businessmen. I do know what the approximate gross revenues are, and we're seeking your cooperation. Now there was a lot of under declaration of gross receipts, so immediately I said that this will not happen under my term. In the same manner that we're seeking operation, we will not accept applications which we believe are the gross receipts are underdeclared. So one trap was raising more money for the city, and I come from the city, I know how they operate, I can compare. I had the ascendancy to tell them that this will not work anymore under this new administration. Now, together with that, we prioritize the problems of the city in terms of what is doable that will inspire confidence in so far as the bureaucracy in the city is concerned. So let's say, for instance, the problem of informal settlers. They organize a federation of seven organizations during that time. They were asking the mayor to work with them, to help them. The mayor, who was mayor for, I think, 15, 16 years, was not able to help them. So this is one area where we can demonstrate that under this new administration, we can work out the arrangements that they were looking for. And in fact, we did. So of course, by word of mouth, they'll say that, these things did not happen in the last 5, 20, 60, whatever. And suddenly, there is this guy after 1 year, he has he has done it.
That's a, I mean, you're seen as a revolutionary figure in large part because of the patronage politics that had characterized the city before. And I wonder how you navigated that difficult first step of, after you've set your priorities, how do you build a team, both in your office, your executive office, and also, you know, these 1530 employees, as they used to call them, and others. How do you purge the bureaucracy? Do you keep the people on who were there before you came and try to work with them?
Ever since my policy has been, and my principle has been, I'll try to work with the people that I have. Probably bring in some new guys who I can trust, who will make sure that everyone will toe the line. But basically, I'm a subscriber to the idea that by nature, if you provide good leadership, you'll be able to institute some changes. I always say that, you know, it's the 20-20-60 rule. 20% of those who are in that organization will always get on board with whoever is in charge. 20% will oppose. The remaining 60 will just watch who wins and goes with the winner. So certainly, if my 20 will win, I'll get the 60. And that worked with me in City Hall. Instead of bringing in new guys, if I recall it right, I only took in one person. He's now the vice mayor. And he has been with me ever since I worked with City Hall. Just to tell everyone that, you know, instead of looking back and finding fault, I'd rather work with you and move on.
And how did you know the vice mayor? Was he a friend?
The vice mayor was with me. Before he was my speechwriter. Oh, okay. He wrote for me. He became vice mayor later on. He was city administrator. But then I worked in another government agency before I became mayor. And he was the guy that I took in. So aside from him, no one else.
And when you're setting these priorities, you mentioned before, I mean, you've got less than 3 years now. You're coming up for re-election again.
Yeah.
Are there certain quick fixes, so to speak, to win the support of the constituents, to show the trust? I mean, can you divide your priorities into the quick fixes and the long-term priorities that may stretch 3, 6, perhaps all 9 years?
You know, I think, you know, you in at the local level, you tend to manage symbols. I think it's important that they do see the symbols of good governance. Let's say, for instance, you know, in that city where, at least during that time, you know almost everyone. When you do something right, everyone knows. When you do something wrong, everyone knows. Mm. And when you manage the symbols, let me just be very, very specific.
Please.
You know, I reported for work very early. I left City. I was the last person to leave City Hall initially, just to impress everyone that, you know, I will not ask of you what I'm not willing to do myself. And of course, we were very frugal. I think I built that reputation in the city that, you know, we don't waste government money. So it's important that you impart the right values, because, you know, the programs will not be implemented well if they're not supported by the right values. So we emphasize to everyone that, you know, we'll say what we do, or we'll do what we say. I mean, and I said that, you know, we'll promote from within, we'll build the capacity from within. So as far as the bureaucracy was concerned, I think after 6 months in office, they felt that, you know, I had the technical and the academic preparation to be mayor, but more than that, I think they felt that, you know, I can lead that organization. Now, of course, outside City Hall, you need to demonstrate outcomes. And as I've said, we look at the difficult that were doable, so that the relocation of the bus terminals, working with the informal settlers, coming up with an emergency rescue system. You know, during that time, there were no cell phones yet. Landlines were inefficient, so we built an emergency rescue system using VHF radios. And we networked with all the hospitals, fire department, and the like. So it was a localized 911 using the available equipment that we have. Because, as I've said, the challenge was making do with what we have. During the first term, it was really making sure that the organization knows that where we're going. So you know, we I think I had monthly meetings with the employees, weekly meetings with the management committee. And we do say, choosing the right battles to fight. We fought illegal gambling. We closed down all the nightclubs in the city.
That was one of your early on initiatives, cleaning up.
As I've said, sometimes you need to work with symbols. Mm. You don't have a lot of money, but you know these are the symbols of bad governance.
But how do you win the political support for those early initiatives? I mean, you're sort of an untested figure, right, so
yes,
to speak, as you come in. And there are a lot of people in the camp who are opposed to your
No,
your
I think it's clear. It was clear to me that I cannot rely on the traditional political support. Because you know, I just won with 23% of the vote. All the village leaders were with me when I ran for office. Almost all of them, more than half of them. And still, I got only 23%. So if I don't go beyond the traditional, then very likely I'll get the other, probably what, an increment of what, 5, 6, 7, 8%. So I decided to take that risk. I told myself that, you know, it's support will come from people who believe that, you know, the city deserves something better. That when they say something better, not only in terms of accomplishment, but in terms of the values that you show, the values that you advocate. In fact, I think during my first term, it was more of, aside from the symbols of what government can do, I think it's making them believe that, you know, we can have a government that that is honest. We can have a government that plays by the rules. So I think they were not looking for quick fix solutions. They were looking for a sign that, you know, this is an opportunity, that if we cultivate this opportunity, then we can do better.
So I want to ask you on the operational detail side about these sort of three priority areas, but before we get to that, just on this initial kind of closing down the various vices in the city, like the pornography shops and other aspects, how does one actually go about cleaning those areas up?
From experience, you cannot fully trust the Philippine National Police at the local level. I recall I organized my own anti-vice squad in City Hall. So they operated for me. In fact, I remember very well I had a fight with my chief of police because he belonged to the opposing political camp. And I had to go to the archbishop so that I can get my own chief of police.
How early on in your term was this?
I think it was
fight?
What, a year and a half within my term.
And what was the reason behind the scuffle?
He was not following orders when we asked him to run after illegal gambling. He was just playing games. So I told myself, you know, if we cannot rely on him, there are two things that I can do. One is get him replaced. The other one is form my own group.
So you form an anti-vice
squad.
And how do you select the members for this anti-vice squad?
This came from the security personnel that they detailed to me. And, you know, we had the makings of a public safety office already in City Hall. So we set up that unit. They ran after all the vices. Despite the fact that we're not that many, when you're doing something legal and something right, no one will oppose you, even if they want to. Even the police cannot even say that, you know, We're stepping beyond our authority, because if they do, I'll tell them, that's your job, I'm doing it for you.
How big was this team, or how big was this squad?
I recall, I think, six police officials and eight civilians.
Uh-huh. And how does one actually go about shutting down?
They just go there.
What does it mean to, if someone else is trying to replicate this strategy, what is it?
You need good intel information. Mm. And at the time that they're committing it, somebody must be there to witness it. Mm-hmm. Then we just apprehend. In fact, one of the joints that we apprehended, I recall it, it was just at the back of the police station. So they just waited when they had the shows, they just apprehended everyone.
It was a brothel? A brothel? Is that what it was? What
it's
was?
It's not a brothel. It's a these are lewd shows, nude okay. ladies, mm-hmm. nude girls. And the following day, we canceled the permits. So they don't have a permit to operate anymore.
Interesting.
We have evidence. You know, it sounds easier than when it was done. Mm.
But what you did when you had this run-in with the chief of police was to go to the archbishop.
Yeah, I talked to the archbishop. Yeah, the archbishop was very close to the president.
To help you mediate the conflict?
No.
Is that, or what
I told the archbishop, you know, I said, Monsignor, I think you see what we're doing. This would be difficult if I don't have the chief of police with me. I knew that the archbishop was close to the president and President Corey. So I asked him if it's possible for him to intercede in my behalf and get my chief of police replaced.
Okay.
I think he talked to the president. A month later, they gave me a new chief of police who now understands that the boss there is City Hall. It's not another politician who doesn't have jurisdiction over us. Mm.
Can I just move, because I recognize your time is limited, just to talk about the operational details of these three sort of areas. So the first is this urban rights program. And for someone who's not familiar with the program, can you describe in detail how that actually, the process of the government going in and buying up
property
worked, what the situation looked like? So you had people that were essentially living on land that but private landowners did own that land, and the government came in and essentially convinced the private landowners
to sell.
How does that work?
First of all, as I've said, when I took over, there were seven organizations. They formed an urban poor federation. And basically what they wanted was tenure, meaning security of tenure. So I asked them what the situation was, how can it be best managed. And they answered that, you know, we're willing to organize. You can only talk to one person, meaning we will be represented by our officers. They can assume obligations for us, or they can accept obligations. And we started inventory. Which of these properties can easily be negotiated? Because, you know, once we've demonstrated that we have the capacity and the willingness to pay. Then most of them were willing to sell their properties. But the problem was that government was not credible in the sense that, you know, they don't pay, it takes too long for them to pay. And anyway, so we chose, I think if I recall right, three or four areas. One property was owned by the church. And we negotiated that the only condition given by the church was that we pay cash. They will only talk to one person, and we need to settle it soon. The concession was that all the open spaces will be given to us for free. They'll sell it at lower than market values, and they'll immediately transfer ownership after we paid. It was a fair deal. So I borrowed money from the bank, paid the church, took over the property, and of course, again, that's easier said than done. It took a while before we were able to convince everyone that this is the price, this is the amortization schedule, these are the obligations. But then, I recall it took us almost a year.
So you borrowed money from?
From the bank.
From the bank, so the government borrows from
the
bank.
We borrowed money from the bank, we bought the property. Now the informal settlers now owe us. Hmm. So we need to arrange the amortization schedules. The other thing that we did was we did land sharing. A property owner felt that, you know, that his property, in as much as part of it was occupied by informal settlers, he was not getting value for his property. Mm. So I said, if he's willing to share the land, we'll pay for part of it. We'll vacate the prime side of it. Anyway, our interest is really housing. We are not interested in using it for commercial purposes. So he agreed to share the land. So we vacated, we paid him, we settled, the same. We did also a land swap. Mm. we own a prop, the city owned the property. Again, this is the church. The church owned a property, but they had informal settlers. And they were about to be ejected because the court decided that this was really the property of the church. Hmm. So we went to the archbishop, and we told the archbishop that, Monsignor, you might be willing to consider a vacant property owned by the city in exchange for your property. Hmm. So we did some computations. We agreed that this is the equivalent area that we'll give him in exchange for his property. So,
if you know what year that was?
I think this was 1990.
Okay.
The first one was 1988.
Okay.
Now, of course, there were occasions wherein we used the authority of government to, we call it eminent domain. Mm. For property owners who were not willing to negotiate, we compelled them to sell the land to the government, and we filed cases.
But it was there. What was the case made in terms of why the government should have ownership of that land?
First of all, housing, as far as local Philippine laws are concerned, housing is public use. It's defined as public use. So if it's for public housing, you can acquire property by force.
So to an audience who's new to this subject, listening to this, some would suggest that perhaps, you know, how does the government, are they strong arming people into giving up their land?
Let's say for instance, if your property is, let's say you own a property, this is occupied by informal settlers. You would like to eject them. I'll pay you a visit. I'll say, probably you're interested to sell the property to the informal settlers. Very like, if he says yes, then we'll negotiate how much. If that my auditor tells me that the price is okay, we'll just pay. Now if you'll say, no, I'm not willing to sell the property, or if the demand is unreasonable, we'll say, so we'll use the authority of government to compel you to sell the property. Hmm. And we'll just pay you based on what the court will tell us is the fair market value of your property. Now, of course, we only do that when you have informal settlers in your property. We don't do that if it's vacant land, no reason to go to court.
So if I'm a property owner and I agree, you come to me and I agree to sell it, who determines how much?
There is an assessment.
Is it a vote within the city council itself?
No.
There is
an appraisal committee.
Okay.
That appraises the property composed of both government and non-government. And if you're not satisfied, you'll go to court. The court will appoint an appraisal committee that will determine the value of the property. So for the informal settlers, basically it was just a land issue. It was much, much later during my term that we started providing houses. In the province, just give them a home lot on an incremental basis, they'll be able to provide a house.
Do you have any idea how much money the government spent in total on?
More than 100 million, I guess.
Basically.
Yeah. Two things. One is that I consider it as a priority.
Hmm. Why is that?
My sense was that. First of all, by just providing tenure to a lot of people, they'll invest in housing. And when you invest in housing, the economic multiplier of housing construction is relatively high. You know. Second, by providing them tenure, it gives them peace of mind and they can focus on the other important concerns of improving their lot. And of course, we have always maintained that the government is for the poor. And we should demonstrate this by way of programs that will address the needs of the poor. In fact, if you try to connect all of these initiatives, even if you go to the school board program that we had, you move to education, it was really our bias for the poorer sector. The reason why we wanted to improve public education in the cities because we felt that it was an equalizer, meaning children of poor families must have the same opportunity as children of well-off families, at least as far as education is concerned.
So let's move to that, if I may, just to talk about the issue of how you empowered the school boards. This is now your second term. You've come back.
Actually,
you've been abroad.
My comeback on my first term of my actually my fourth term.
Okay.
We have always considered that our public school system in the city as more superior to the other divisions in the region. But you know, when we examined the results of the achievement test, it seems that, you know, we were not doing well. 39% average, you know, meaning for 100 questions that were asked, only 39 were answered correctly.
This is in a particular grade or
actually
school,
that's
or?
Average for grade 1 to grade 6, math, science, English. And you know, I told myself that probably we're the best in the region, but 39 is not good enough. And we tried to do an assessment. Two things. One is there was a lot of awareness on the part of not only the school, not only but also the parents, that the progress insofar as the progress of our public school system is concerned. And you know, when they're not really that aware, you cannot expect them to act on it. So I propose that, you know, from here on, let's make public education a joint responsibility between the parents and the school, and let's come up with mechanisms that will enforce it. So at the top, of course, is the school board. So we agree that everything that the school board decides should be the result of consultation with those who are involved, from parents to educators to supervisors to teachers. So we agreed that we'll expand the membership of the school board. We'll actively consult with the stakeholders. We'll redefine the mandate. We're not the performance officer of the division.
But you must have faced some opposition to this because this the school board is a special body set up under the 1991 local ordinance, local government code. So people must be saying, well, the code of 91 doesn't say that you as a school board can do what you're doing. How did you navigate that?
First of all, the school board really is controlled by the local government, not by DepEd. If you take a look at the membership. So if you call a vote, usually the mayor will get his way. But as they say, you cannot argue with a good idea. In fact, when we said that we'll reinvent the school board, we'll giving you more authority, but we'll not be measuring you. So we were saying that, you know, from here on, the principal, the supervisor, the superintendent is now part of the process of deciding as to how we'll spend the money. Whereas before, it was just the mayor who decides and the superintendent. So between a setup wherein authority was limited to two people, now we're saying that, you know, we'll spread around the authority and now get all of you involved. But then the precondition is we'll measure. I guess by and large, measurement was just to make sure that we're on track.
Did you have to hire any special staff from the outside to come in to do this measurement? No.
In fact, we pioneered the reinvention in the Philippines. It was just I guess in all of this, it was really more of responding to the challenges given the resources that you have. Let's say, for instance, urban poor. It was responding to a demand or a request coming from the sector that, you know, you better take care of us. We've been waiting for a long time. You know, we're willing to do our share as long as you help us. In like manner, in public education, as I've said, if I can assure the parents that, you know, we'll improve the achievement levels of your children, if you just go on board and actively participate, there will be some rewards in case you do. They cannot argue.
What was the greatest challenge you faced as mayor in empowering the school board?
The national government. In three instances when I had problems, it was when they replaced my division superintendent by someone who did not believe in what we were doing, because this was more political than anything else.
And for someone who's not familiar with the term divisional superintendent,
the superintendent is my counterpart. He or she co-chairs. He's the highest public school, he's the highest DepEd official in the city.
Appointed from the national level.
Appointed by the national government. Let me just give you the political dimension.
I think this is interesting for others who are trying to.
The superintendent is one of the three members of the board of canvassers in the elections. So he's an important personality in the political dynamics in the area. The congressman was my opponent, so he was more influential. I belong to the opposition. So he was able to get my superintendent replaced by somebody who was loyal to him. And not necessarily somebody who had the best interest of the school children in mind. But then, you know, you just have to pound it, no matter, even if you know that he's there, they'll not fully cooperate.
So when he's appointed, what do you do? How do you, are you able to get him out, or does
not
he,
really.
Does he stay?
You just have to work with him.
What does that mean?
You just have to
mean?
Work with him. As I've said, there will be no debates, no discussions when the ideas are sound. You only will have problems when the things that you would like to do run contrary to DepEd rules or run contrary to generally accepted rules. But when they're consistent with all the rules, then she cannot argue.
So what might have, if you could provide maybe a specific example of something that you were trying to do but the national level didn't want to see happen and there
not,
was
not
tension?
Not really the national level. It's actually just the superintendent. Let's say, for instance, I wanted to do quarterly achievement tests. Probably she felt lazy. Probably she didn't see the sense of it. She only wanted a pre-test and a post-test. But, you know, I said that, you know, the only way for us to intervene is when we know at the middle of the game that we're not performing well. It's not that we'll know that we did not perform at the end of the game. That's a post-test. So there was a running discussion on that. In as much as they control the teachers and the principals, we only had a pretest and a post-test.
So you had to essentially give in to her demands.
So it's really a give and take thing.
And in terms of the program overall, how did you measure the success?
Which one?
Of the education of the empowering of the school board? What were the measures?
Simple.
For
improvement in achievement levels of children. That's basic. They do an achievement test. If the scores goes up, several. You have a division, you have a national, you have a regional. So you triangulate, have my numbers improved. If they did, then the ultimate measurable outcome is clear. Mm-hmm. You take a look at completion rates and participation rates. If the numbers have gone up, then I think the outcome is clear. Mm-hmm. All of the activities that you're doing are just really activities. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, the basic outcomes are making sure that they're done, they're finished, making sure that the achievement levels are up.
And I just want to move to the last sort of area of discussion, which was the Naga City People's Council, which preceded the empowerment ordinance. Can you tell me, where did that idea come from, and why did you decide to make this a priority?
The political dimension in that ordinance was, you know, we need to, we always do say that, you know, basic principle. If there is anyone who can do it better than government, let them do it. That has been an overriding principle in everything that we did in the city. And we felt that if there was an NGO who was willing to do what government needs to do, and government does not have the capacity to do, then they can do it. So we started with that. No? Let's say, for instance, the School for the Mentally Handicapped Children in the city is really run by parents of handicapped children for the simple reason that we don't have any expertise in it. So for things that the private sector can do better than us, we so operationally that people participation ordinance it revolves into two aspects. One is that getting private sector to participate in the service delivery system of the city. The other dimension is getting them involved in policy. Now, as I've said, I only won with 23% of the vote. My lesson there was that, you know, if people will get on board in most of the things that we do, you know, I'll get my numbers. In fact, again, if you take a look at the numbers, I think it was a very fair assessment since from my first re-election up to the last election, 80%, 70% of the mandate. So we took off from believing that, you know, if we can get everyone on board, we'll be better off.
So in terms of actually passing the empowerment ordinance, was that a vote by the city council?
It was a vote by the city council.
But and was it, were you, when you first tried to propose the idea, did you think you were going to be able to get it passed easily, or was there opposition?
Since, you know, since 1992 up to now, we don't have any opposition councilor in the city. We've been voted straight into office, meaning my mayor, vice mayor, all the city council just belong to one political group.
The Liberal
Party. Or at least my party, whenever that was. So the challenge really was not only asking them to vote for it, but making them part of it. Because, you know, initially people, at least two councilors, were saying, why is it that we need to get NGO representatives when we were given the full mandate? You know, my answer then, if I recall it right, was, you know, local officials come and go. If there is anything permanent here, it's a constituency.
Interesting.
And probably at this point in time, we might say that, you know, we're good local officials, but we're not sure whether the succeeding local officials will be good, no? At least just to console them. No? So it was more prospective than anything else. But to my mind, it was important that, you know, we begin to learn to listen from people who might not have the chance to be elected, in as much as, you know, we have an imperfect political and election system in the Philippines. It doesn't follow that whoever is voted into office deserves it. And the only way to make sure that people are represented is if you can pass that local law that will require government to have people representatives. So initially we had some resistance, but then, you know, they realized later on that politically it was beneficial to them as well. Very, very simple.
And that resistance came from members of your own party councillors.
Yeah. I think that the basic premise is simple. If you're a voter, I'll ask you to vote for me and tell you that, you know, after you vote for me, I'm in charge. And there is this other fellow who'll say, after you vote for me, we'll govern this together.
It's interesting you say that, because I wonder, as your popularity increased over your terms as mayor, I wonder if councillors were more inclined to go along with what you as mayor were proposing. There was less resistance as your time went on in the first term, 9 years, and then the second, you know, because they knew what you were saying. People really bought into and believed in. So, was it easier to navigate the political?
Immediately after that, during my first election, I got 80% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So from 23%, I went 80%, and of course, probably some of them were looking at it as a fluke, no, initially. But, you know, when after 80, you get 76. I think not 76. After 80, I get, I think, 91. Then like, I came back, I got 76. Then 71, then 77. In fact, some of them, I do think, no, that some of them thought that they owe their election to me. But then, I guess we didn't agree all the time. You know, I've never imposed anything on them. It's always, you better be convinced that this is the way to go. It's not, in as much as, you know, you belong to my ticket, no matter where we go, you'll go with me.
Right. Yeah. But do you think that opposition from some of your members, the opposition to the idea of an Aga City People's Council, was because it would actually make the dealings of these special bodies and committees actually more transparent? Now they couldn't perhaps bargain amongst themselves, but, you know, now we have to let the civil society guys into here what we're trying to do. So there were
partly,
some.
I think partly they were not comfortable that, you know, these are now outsiders. They do not belong to our political group, and now they're part of the deliberation process. They might not understand where we're coming from. So it was more of the discomfort rather than the threat. Because you know in that ordinance, while it allows private sector participation, they're a minority in a committee of five. There's only one representative. So it's more of just making everyone know what's happening. It's not dictating as to what will happen. But I think later on they realized that it was good for our politics. I mean, you know, after the first re-election in 1992, I think everyone realized that, you know, this is good for us. Good for us both in the political and the developmental dimension. Meaning, they can use the People's Council against what I want. Mm-hmm. In like manner, I can use the People's Council against what they want. It's not all the time that we agree. Mm. And we need to get people on board. So I suppose they understood that in general, it will benefit everyone. Mm.
As we work our way to a conclusion, I just wanted to ask, when you look back over 18 years as mayor, is there anything that you were not able to do that you wish you had been able to?
Many things.
Maybe the top one or two areas where you ran into resistance, or you just simply, the political situation or the fiscal situation wouldn't allow for it?
You know, I think we should have been less conservative in terms of generating resources. Let's say, for instance, World Bank did a study and they were saying that, you know, we under-borrowed. And that probably to a certain extent they were right. But to my mind, it was more political than anything else. Mm-hmm. They piloted NAGA in a Standard and Poor's rating system project. And I think we fared fairly well as compared to all the Philippine cities that were rated. So maybe you could have fast-tracked the development if you were more aggressive. Now, of course, the other thing that I think we should have looked at was, of course, this is more parochial. No? I was not very concerned with history, arts, and culture. But you know, sometimes these things when you pass on the opportunity, it's gone. So in terms of work, I think that was one area where I think we should focus some resources and some attention. So in so far as specifics as to what we've done, I think we should have focused more on, or not really more focus, put some emphasis on it. And probably we should have been tougher. I guess that people empowerment ordinance really put a soft dimension on how we govern. And sometimes there are times when I guess the process becomes tedious. Although, of course, We do say that, you know, looking back, that process improved the outcomes. Let's say, for instance, at this point in time, we have not decided where to locate the landfill. Because that process is always inclusive. And, you know, I doubt if you'll get full consensus on where to locate it. So these are tricky issues that I guess... I think government must just decide, of course, after listening to everyone. But this cannot be done by consensus of everyone else. But other than that, I guess we're okay.
And finally, I wonder if there are other cities that have adapted.
Many cities already, actually.
Yeah, because there's quite a bit.
Yeah, Quezon City has a Quezon City People's Council. It's not as powerful as we do, as what we have in the city, but they have one. They have Candelaria People's Council. It's the same as ours in this Quezon province. They have an Infanta People's Council in Infanta Quezon. They have a South Upi Maguindanao People's Council. I think they learned this from SIDA. But I think the direction is towards that. Right now, we're working with the Senate to, in fact, make the budgeting process of LGUs more inclusive to NGOs. And we're proposing a law that will compel that. Now the recent Congress passed in the you know what we call the General Appropriations Act, the budget, mm-hmm. In the Philippines, wherein full disclosure is now compulsory for local government units. Actually, that comes from the Naga City experience. So my sense is that we're moving towards more participation and more empowerment on the part of non-government. Give us until 2016, we'll make sure that all of these are translated into laws.
Secretary Roberto, thank you very much
yeah,
for your time.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.